This podcast is brought to you by ClearBridge Investments. Meet an evolving economy confidently with ClearBridge Active Equities, the foundation of a resilient portfolio. ClearBridge, a Franklin Templeton company. Go to clearbridge.com to learn more.
Please stay tuned for important disclosure information at the conclusion of this episode.
Hi, and welcome to The Long View. I'm Christine Benz, Director of Personal Finance for Morningstar, Inc.
And I'm Jeff Batak, Global Director of Manager Research for Morningstar Research Services.
Every week on this podcast, we'll talk to thought leaders on money and investing. We'll mainly interview experts outside of Morningstar, but we'll also tap our internal experts for their opinions. We could think of no better person to talk to than Morningstar's own Don Phillips. Jeff and I have both felt Don's personal influence in our careers, and Don has also been a towering presence in the mutual fund industry, having provided analysis and commentary on funds since the mid-1980s. Don was Morningstar's first mutual fund analyst, and he established the independent voice that all Morningstar analysts thereafter took a cue from. He helped bring about a lot of the tools that investors today take for granted, such as the Morningstar Style Box and the Morningstar Rating, often referred to as the Star Rating. Don has served in a variety of leadership roles at Morningstar, most recently as head of global research, before paring back his schedule to take on a part-time non-management role. Don has received numerous accolades over the years. Most recently, he received the Matthew R. MacArthur Industry Pioneer Award from the Investment Management Consultants Association in 2016. Don, thank you so much for being here.
Well, thanks, Christine. It's nice to be here with you and Jeff.
Let's start by talking about your early interest in Morningstar. Morningstar lore holds that you began investing when you were a paperboy, that you had some extra money and you wanted to put it into a mutual fund. Let's talk about how you got to even know what a mutual fund was.
So I was a paperboy all throughout middle school and high school, starting about sixth grade. And, you know, it's an everyday job. It's a great discipline. I think our family only took one vacation during that entire time. So, you know, every single day, rain or shine, ice storms, thunderstorms, you know, you were out there delivering the papers, which was a great sort of work ethic that you get out of that. But then one year when I was in middle school, my father bought me 100 shares of the Templeton Growth Fund. And I always thought it was interesting that he bought 100 shares because he was thinking like stocks. You buy a round lot. You know, today you always think about a mutual fund, you buy a certain dollar amount. But he came at it more from a stock side than the mutual fund side. And he sat me down and he explained, you know, this is a mutual fund. Here's what it does. He showed me the shareholder report and he showed me the list of companies that you now own a little bit of each of these companies. And Sir John Templeton is your money manager, and he makes the decisions on what stocks to buy and to sell and to hold. And I remember we would watch Wall Street Week together. My dad watched that every week, but the weeks that John Templeton was on, I would watch with him. And I remember thinking that was so cool. You know, this guy is my money manager. You know, I'm this little paper boy, the least significant investor on the planet, and yet Sir John Templeton is my personal money manager. And that was sort of the magic of mutual funds to me. That just made sense as a way to invest. And I remember being in college talking to some of my fraternity brothers, and they would say things like, oh, my dad and I are playing the market. We're buying this stock or the other. And I thought, you know, what do you know about the market? How are you and your dad going to outguess, you know, these powerful research houses? It just seemed to me that the discipline, the professional management, the diversification that you got with funds were just made an enormous amount of sense. And so when it came time to sort of go into the field of finance, that's what I wanted to do, something about mutual funds, you know, helping people to access them and use them wisely, because it seemed to me as a great way to go.
So did you know that you wanted to focus on finance, though, as an undergrad, or you were pursuing an English major, right?
Well, I was an economics major as an undergraduate through, you know, the first part of my career, and then realizing that that would be far too productive, I switched to English, and which was a real passion of mine. I love literature, and so I went into graduate school in English, the thinking being that I would be a literature professor, but I'd be an active investor on the side. I'd try to live frugally, save and invest money, and that would be an important part of my you know, my overall set of activities. And then I got to the end of the master's program, and you had to make a decision. Do you want to lock yourself in a library for the next 5 or 6 years in pursuit of the PhD? And that was just hard for me. I had gotten married. My wife and I moved to Chicago. She was going off to work every day, and I was going into a library to read. And I guess maybe having that paperboy discipline, always having a job growing up, I just didn't sit well with me. So I decided to shift things around, and rather than being a literature professor and investing on the side, I was looking for a job writing about researching investments and then hoping to read the great books on the side. So what I wanted to be was a mutual fund analyst, but I had no idea that that career path didn't exist. And fortunately, right at that moment, Joe Mansueto created that career path. He took out an ad in the Chicago Tribune that said, wanted mutual fund writer. And I called him up and said, I'm your man. And came in, we had an interview, we talked about John Templeton, and 2 days later he called up and offered me the job.
So let's talk about the early days of the fund industry, or the 80s for the fund industry, what it was like, the number of funds, also transparency for fund investors. It was quite dissimilar from what we have today.
Yeah, it was very different. There are far fewer funds, but they were much more expensive funds. And there really wasn't much discrimination. Bad funds were often the biggest funds. You know, today the assets very much flow to the better players, those that have created better experiences for investors. But back then that wasn't the case. It was more distribution might that determined who had the assets. And the big players were largely the brokerage houses, which often had very mediocre funds and sometimes just terrible funds. I mean, Dean Witter had a dreadful lineup of funds. There were funds that were designed to be easy to sell, so they'd have super high yields, but with that came all kinds of risks, and they often blew up on investors. So, you know, they were, in my mind, kind of dark days for the industry. It was one very much marked by salesmanship as opposed to, you know, what we've come to treasure here at Morningstar, stewardship. You know, it was a place where, you know, I think very much funds were bought, not sold. And if you went to mutual fund industry conferences, that's what people would talk about. They'd get up and say, mutual funds are bought, or mutual funds are sold, not bought. Meaning that, you know, if you had the distribution muscle, it didn't matter what the quality of the fund was. You could find ways to ensnare investors into your funds. So in my mind, it was not a great period for the industry. But that doesn't mean that there weren't, you know, lots and lots of points of light. There were lots of great young boutique shops. There were quality shops like Vanguard and T. Rowe and Fidelity, American funds. But they didn't necessarily have the big assets. You know, the assets tended to be with the ones that owned distribution. So that's been a major change.
Can you take us back to that time and maybe looking through the lens of an investor who is trying to choose a mutual fund or fill out an investment portfolio? I mean, what sort of challenges would they face? And then for you as a young analyst working at Morningstar, how did we try to respond to meet those needs?
Well, the big challenge was just getting quality information on the funds. I remember the first day I was at Morningstar, Joe got a copy of the Weisenberger book and set it on my desk and said, here's a good thing to read. It's got a lot of information on funds. And the Weisenberger books were in libraries, and they would come out each year in September with the total return information through the end of the prior year. So at its absolute freshest, the information was 9 months old. You know, isn't that amazing today? Today, you know, you know 9 minutes after the market closes, you know what the price of your mutual fund is. You're, with an ETF, you know every millisecond during the day what it trades at. You know, back then, it took 9 months to figure out what your return was from the prior year and then to get comparisons to other funds to see how it really stacked up. So that's a way that clearly the industry has changed. There's so much more transparency, so much more access to information. And I think that was a big part of Morningstar, is using technology to find ways to democratize data and get information, you know, not just in the hands of a few elite, but out there to a much broader audience so that more people could make informed investment decisions.
What was that process like in the early days where basically we had to, I imagine, call out to fund companies or other influencers in the industry and convince them to be more transparent and forthcoming? What sort of response did you and Joe get in those early days?
Well, we'd said to get people to answer the phone and, you know, explain who we were. One thing that really helped is we got a contract. Joe secured a contract with Business Week magazine to do what was called the Business Week Mutual Fund Scoreboard. And it was done in February of each year with information through the end of the prior year. And it was done at the time when most of the asset flows were happening in the industry, because it was very much focused around the IRA market back then. So people, you know, doing the retirement accounts, they had to get money in by April 15th. And this thing became very, very popular. And Forbes had something that they'd done for years, a mutual fund scoreboard, but it came out in the fall, kind of like in August. It was sort of a dead time. They said, okay, here's a good time to do the mutual fund issue. But it wasn't a time when people were buying funds. So this Business Week fund issue became very important for the industry. And all of a sudden, we started sending out surveys to fund companies that used to come out just under the name Morningstar. Now it said for use in the Business Week Mutual Fund Scoreboard. We got all of the information back much more quickly and had better access. So we kind of used we tried to create pull demand either through media clients that we had and then later through financial advisors who were using Morningstar. And I remember one very important situation was with Putnam. Putnam, you know, just wouldn't talk to us. They wouldn't take our calls. They say, we don't care, you know, about you. We've never heard about you. We tell brokers what to think about our funds. We don't need someone else telling them anything about them. You're just kind of mucking up our message. So, you know, we don't want to take your calls. But Fortune magazine was doing a big profile on Putnam, and I remember Josh Mendez, the reporter, was out there, and they were rolling out the red carpet for Josh, and they were, you know, taking him from manager to manager, and their PR person noticed that in between the interviews with managers, he was pulling out these sheets and looking at them and making notes and circling things, and he was using the Morningstar Mutual Fund pages that he had mimeographed and as his background research for the interviews, and all of a sudden a light went off in Putnam's head. They said, wait a minute, well, we may not care about Morningstar, but we darn sure care about Fortune. And if Fortune cares about Morningstar and is reading Morningstar first to sort of set their grounding for what they think about us, we need to really make sure that Morningstar has access to, you know, to the information and understands our story as well as possible. So it was always that pull demand that we got from the media or from advisors that changed the behavior of the fund companies and got us access to more information.
At what point did you start asking for the manager interviews? So you were initially asking for data, right, and then the manager interviews.
Yeah. Joe had been doing a quarterly publication called the Mutual Fund Sourcebook for about 2 years when I started. He started in 84. I started in 86. I was hired as the first analyst to add some text and some context to the data. So Joe had built up the data on about 600 or 700 equity funds. We didn't cover any fixed income funds at the beginning. But he had this idea for these one-page reviews that would have analyst commentary on them. So that was my job, was to add that commentary. So my first job was to read 777 mutual fund prospectuses and write up summaries of how they invested, and then to pick out, you know, which funds went into this book, and then to sequence them, and then to start calling up fund managers and asking them questions. So that was the real challenge. And, you know, when I started at Morningstar, you know, I had spent more time on English than on economics, and I wasn't a professional investor. But I just set out reading an investment book a week for the first 2 years I was at Morningstar. We lived way up in Rogers Park, which is about a 45-minute L ride to where the office was. And so I could read for 45 minutes on the way in, 45 minutes going home. We were at the end of the line in each time or at each location, so you could always get a seat. And I just sort of plugged away trying to get up to speed so I could have good conversations with the fund managers. And one of the things you realize is that when you're having an interview with a fund manager is the initial part of the conversation is you're figuring out just what level you're going to have this conversation on. You know, they're asking themselves, do I have to dial this down to a real remedial level that this guy will understand, or can we have a more sophisticated conversation? And so trying to learn more about the industry, more about investing, so that you could have a meaningful conversation with managers was an important part of the job. And the nice thing is that we got some very good support early on from a great number of managers. Not all of them. My entire, you know, career interviews with Stan Druckenmiller consisted of the words, not interested, click. But there were others who, you know, Chuck Royce and others who were very generous with their time, took an interest in what we were doing, came out to visit us, and were very supportive and were making suggestions like, oh, are you also covering this manager? You know, we really like this person. We like this team over here. We'd be interested in your analysis of them. So you started to build up a community of managers and people that understood what we were doing, and they were extremely supportive.
You have been very involved in hiring analysts, and in the early days there really weren't mutual fund analysts or it wasn't a well-trod career path. So what sorts of things were you looking for when you were enlarging the team?
You know, that building the team was the big second part after figuring out how to, you know, read enough investment books to ask intelligent questions to managers. So one was learning kind of how to be an analyst. But then the second thing was, okay, how do you become an editor? How do you build a team? And the first couple of people that we hired weren't particularly good. And at first I thought, you know, oh, hey, you know, I'm kind of better than these people. You know, I seem to be stronger at this than some of the people that we were hiring. But then a light went off and said, well, wait a minute. It doesn't matter how good I am. If we don't surround ourselves with a group of really good people, this thing is never going to fly. And so the real key to me was getting that first core of analysts. And it was bringing John Reckenthaler on board, Kathy Gillis, Udelbu on board, and then Lori Lucas. Lori was a typist for us at the time. And talking to her, I could tell she was a lot brighter than some of these MBAs that we were hiring as analysts. And so I made her an analyst. And she's gone on to have a wonderful career at Ibbotson and at Hewitt and at Callan, and just has made a huge contribution to the defined contribution space. So I'm really proud of that core team. But that was the key thing, is building a team, because it can't be a one-person effort. And I think that's a lesson in business, is that at the end of the day, it's who you surround yourself with and who are the people that are going to carry on the tradition that's much more important than what you as one person can do.
In terms of the public role, one thing that has really struck me is that you were very much Morningstar's public face, still are, but you also encouraged the analysts to get out there and talk to the Wall Street Journal, be on TV. Why was that so important to you to build that underlying team of public faces?
Well, one was to find someone like yourself who can do this all much better than I ever could. You've done an absolutely brilliant job at that, Christine. But the big thing was, we were trying to serve well at the journalists who were calling us up. I remember one of our competitors, they had rules about who could talk to the press and who couldn't. And almost everything had to go through the CEO, because he was very worried about upsetting some of his clients, the fund companies. He didn't want to step on any toes. And so journalists would call him up and ask him questions about, what's happening in the industry. And they'd always get this view from 30,000 feet. And I remember one quote he had in the Wall Street Journal that said, he was asked about Fidelity's funds. And he said, their funds are better than some, not as good as others. And I remember thinking, well, that's true for every fund family save two, right? Someone's best and someone's worse, and everyone else is in the middle. Journalists didn't find that very useful. And what we did is said, well, rather than just having me pontificate about any issue that comes up, if someone calls up and asks, says, hey, I've got a question about what's happening with high-yield bond funds, we'd let them talk to the analyst who covered high-yield bond funds. And that analyst could say, oh, yeah, that's an interesting question that you raise. Well, there are these managers that think this way, and then there's other managers that think this way. And they could give them the lay of the land and really help them write their article. And so what happened then is that the next time that journalist had a question, they stopped calling our competitors and they started just calling us, because they knew they would get more bang for their buck, if you will. They'd get a more meaningful answer. They get some traction towards completing their article. And so that it just came from that. It was the way to give the best response was to put someone who to have someone answering the questions who actually knew the answers to them. And we tried to be very responsive to the press and to financial advisors or individuals who called. Anyone who took the time to call us up, we wanted to take seriously. And tried to serve them well. And so it really just came from that effort of trying to help people, which was our mission.
One of the jobs that you and Joe attempt to tackle was shining a light on what funds were actually doing. So let's talk about the prospectus objectives, which were really the main system for classifying funds when you started, and how the style box attempted to really take a step forward on that front.
Well, the style box came out of listening to independent advisors. It was at an ICFP retreat where a bunch of advisors were sitting around saying, how do I explain to my clients why we have more than one equity fund in their portfolio? They'd say, well, look, we already have a U.S. stock fund. Why do we need a second? Let's add a gold fund or something, esoteric like that. And the advisors would say, yeah, I could see adding a gold fund, but that's not the second fund we add. That's maybe the seventh or the eighth. How do we explain that just because you have one equity fund, you perhaps haven't covered all of the equity markets? And how could you explain how two funds might be complementary and another two might just be overlapping? And that was the idea of the style box, to kind of give you a sense of what part of the economy a manager was mining. And the idea was for it to be descriptive. We never meant for it to be restrictive, to be the style police and tell managers you can buy this stock but not that stock. That was never our intent. We just wanted investors to understand what the fund was actually doing. And if you think back then, the names were in the industry, you had more creativity than they do today, but they tended not to be very helpful in helping you understand what the fund was actually doing. You know, you had to be an insider to know that Windsor was a value fund and Janus was a growth fund, that they bought very different stocks and you should set completely different expectations for the performance of those two funds. So this was a way of just helping to, you know, add some clarity to the playing field. That ended up giving us a tool that we could turn the tables on the fund companies, because before that there was a huge amount of excitement or effort put in on fund companies on trying to be number one in their category. And the easiest way to be number one in your category is to be miscategorized. And fund companies back then essentially had the ability to create or to choose their own category. If they called it a growth and income fund, it went into the growth and income bucket, even if it had no income, seeking activities whatsoever. And so at times where, growth was in favor over income, they would be the number one growth and income fund. And we realized that these categories were largely being used to serve the industry, not investors. And we said, well, why don't we just turn this around and come up with categories that make sense from the investor's point of view. And that's one of those subtle ways where, having the same database but having a different point of view means that you manipulate it differently, you present it differently. And taking control of the categorization system, taking it out of the hands of marketers that were trying to use it to make each fund look as good as possible, and putting it in the hands of advisors and investors who cared about what are the implications that I should be setting for these funds so that I can deploy them successfully. It was a huge sea change.
In the early days, I remember, of Morningstar, there was, in fact, some threatened litigation, right, that you stepped on some toes of fund companies.
Oh, there was actual litigation. There was a fund company that no longer exists called Pilgrim that ran an ad, a high-profile ad in the Wall Street Journal that went from the top of the page to the bottom of the page, and it said, "Has anything like this ever happened before?" And there were five boxes on the page with big numerals, number one, number two, number three, number four, number five. And then if you read the fine print, there was a little asterisk said in its category. And so the implication was that somehow Pilgrim had the top five mutual funds. But the reality is they'd really sort of chosen very carefully to craft this one through five. They had one fund that was number one in one category. They had another fund that had multiple share classes that was like number two and hence also number three and four in another category. And then another fund, I think it was a closed-end fund, that was number five in some third category. And they'd strung these together as if to create the impression that they had the five best performing mutual funds. And I pointed out that this was just sort of manipulating the statistics in a way that painted an unflattering picture. And I wrote a commentary called Lies, Damn Lies, and Fund Advertisements. And they didn't like it, and so they sued me. And there was a libel claim. They sued me for more money, many times my net worth at the time. They also sued Morningstar. But ultimately, when we got someone to read this, the California Supreme Court threw the case out saying, as much as Pilgrim didn't like the commentary, they couldn't point out anything that wasn't true in it, and that ultimately truth remains the perfect defense from libel. The case got thrown out, but it took over a year and a half, and it really took its toll. I feel for people that have to go through that kind of thing. Unfortunately, we live in a society where someone can make someone else's life miserable just through litigation.
So, Don, I wanted to ask you about a relatively new concept in the fund industry, which is free. the fund industry is not known for giving things away, and yet one of the things that we've seen in recent years is free index funds. And I think the notion, generally speaking, is that as costs move towards zero, that funds will be treated more like commodities. And so I was curious, just as somebody that's been in the industry, observed the industry for many, many years, what do you think the implications of that are for first the industry and then also by extension investors, particularly with a focus on any sort of unintended consequences that you think that shift could create for them?
Yeah, it certainly isn't something that you would have anticipated 20 years ago. In fact, fees were generally overlooked because they were collected so seamlessly in the industry. So it was an industry where for years, people that were just mediocre at what they did could have a great business with super high profit margins. And clearly that's less and less the case, and in the future will almost certainly not be the case at all. But the one trend that's in place here that I don't see changing is that we're going to have better and better deals for the investor. We've moved from a world where mutual funds were sold, not bought, to one where they're bought, not sold. And it's really a buyer's market today. And sellers are responding by driving their costs all the way down to zero. Now, are there downsides to that? Almost certainly. You know, there is something good about investing in investment talent and having an investment analyst. They perform a useful task for society. I mean, you forget that in indexing because a lot of people are piggybacking on the talents of active managers through index funds, which collectively represent, you know, all of the bets that active managers are making. But there is a value to society for having trained analysts looking at securities, forcing corporate management to be better, and as prices go down lower and lower, you're going to have less ability to reinvest in, you know, that kind of R&D, if you will, for the investment management industry. And I think that will ultimately have negative consequences.
A related question is whether the attention has been too much on fund expense ratios, whereas other parts of financial services fees haven't received as much scrutiny. Is that of concern to you?
Yeah, it is. I mean, you know, we're just sort of crowd animals. You know, we gravitate to one subject and focus on it exclusively and ignore other things. Look at the news cycle. You know, there are all kinds of events that have huge importance that we ignore for weeks and months or years, and then suddenly we become all infatuated with them. Certainly, mutual fund expenses are a very important thing. And, you know, Jack Bogle, you know, very properly pointed out the importance of cost. But it's not the only thing. There's so many more dynamics that go into getting the right investor into the right fund for the right reason. And you can have a low-cost portfolio that's wildly inappropriate for an investor that leads to a disastrous outcome that you can't declare a victory simply because it was done in a cost-efficient manner.
In hindsight, was the period when you evolved as a mutual fund analyst, the 80s and 90s, when I became a fund analyst, do you think that there was a disproportionate focus on security selection and the difference you could make with security selection at the expense of some of the other factors like asset allocation and other considerations?
I think that's almost certainly the case. And certainly, you know, Ibbotson, which a company that is now part of Morningstar, was long advocating the superior importance of asset allocation. But, you know, intuitively, you just sort of tend to think, gee, security selection must be important. This stock went up this much. This one went down that much.
Right. And
so people naturally focused on that. And you want to believe in, you know, superstar managers, investment talent. I still believe it exists. But the reality is you can piggyback on that talent very inexpensively with an index fund, and the cost argument has become you know, very, very compelling. So, but part of this also might be getting into maybe looking at investing in maybe a little less, you know, with big eyes and a little more practical matter. And what really matters in investing is, do we create good experiences? Do investors meet their goal? And at the end of the day, I think we're all in the behavior modification business. You know, are we helping people to tone down the fear and greed cycle and help them chart an intelligent, rational path towards their goals? And at the end of the day, if the investor wins, you know, this whole industry has done its job. But if the investor loses, then all of us have failed to some degree.
You mentioned manager interviews, Don, and I know that's always been a big part of the analyst job. But we're getting clear indications from investors that they're preferring index products. We're seeing that trend pretty vividly. So let's talk about the role of evaluating active managers. Does it still seem worthwhile? Does it seem like we should devote more energies elsewhere? What's your take on that question?
Well, clearly it's still very valuable because there's massive amounts of money that are in active managers, and there are huge numbers of individuals whose retirement fortunes, whose prospects are tied to what those managers are doing. You're right, more money is going into passive, and that's been you know, terrific from a cost standpoint. You know, in many cases, your traditional index fund that Jack Bogle is a huge fan of makes enormous sense. It's a good investment choice. But you're getting, you know, passive is getting more active every day as you get into things like strategic beta, and you're getting more and more, you know, manager spins on that. But when you're talking about funds that are now run by an algorithm, you can't go in and do an interview with an algorithm. So you have to understand some of the personality of the organization that put this together, and we have to find digital ways to go in and understand and decode what the algorithm is, what makes one strategic beta fund different from another, or what makes one index fund different from another. You know, people act as if it's moving to indexing and it's just one big thing, but there are millions more indexes than there are stocks out there. And there's more funds than stocks, and there's more indexes than funds. So there's a huge amount of work still to be done in the field of indexing to understand what are the assumptions that different index providers make and what implications do those have for portfolio deployment.
Don, I know that we have all talked a lot about Jack Bogle and his legacy in the wake of his recent passing, but can you share that with people listening about Mr. Bogle's influence on Morningstar and on you personally?
Well, Jack became a close friend over the years. I mean, I'm not saying that, you know, we were family or anything like that, but he was just always a kind, supportive person. And I think philosophically, we had a lot of things in common in our views of the industry and putting investors first. And he reached out early to Morningstar. He was very supportive of what we were doing. Always had suggestions for how we could do it better, and his suggestions were always, you know, very well thought out, and we implemented a lot of them through the years. So he just became an incredibly important part of my life and of Morningstar's life, and for many, many investors. And I think that's the important thing. I don't think of Jack as gone. What I do is celebrate the fact that his legacy will live on for generations, and that investors yet to be born are going to benefit from the things that he championed. So in my mind, Jack is very, very much with us today. He's part of the spirit of Morningstar. He's part of the spirit of the best parts of this industry. And there are many people in this industry that are here today because of, you know, their admiration for Jack and what he did. But, you know, an interesting thing about Jack is that, you know, he was talking about when I started in the industry in the 1980s. You know, to me, I would look at, you know, the progress of the industry since the 1980s and see lots of progress, whereas Jack would often look back to this nostalgic view of this profession that he knew in the 40s or the 50s and would see deterioration. And so the interesting thing is, you know, it's where's your starting point? But one of the things that Jack would always do is when he looked at the industry, he would discount Vanguard and take it out and say, well, look at this other stuff. It's all overpriced. And I'd say, well, gee, when I look at the industry, a lot of what I see is Vanguard, and it's a wonderful part of the industry. And then there are these, you know, these boutique managers that are very good, and there are other places that improved their practices because of the competition that that Jack created. And so I tended to see the progress where he saw the deterioration. But I think that's an important note is that, you know, even if you never had a penny in index funds or a penny in Vanguard's funds, you benefited from Jack's presence because the competition that he created forced prices down across the industry. And the pressure that he put on regulators and others improved disclosure, and it made the industry more transparent and more accountable to investors. And that's a legacy that will live on and on.
Are investors overdoing their stampede out of active products in favor of low-cost index products, in your opinion?
Probably. I mean, people always react to what's been in favor in the recent past, and index has done very well. But you can't get away, as Jack said, you can't get away from arithmetic. The lower costs are very important. And what this has done is it's raised the bar for active managers. And for a long time, firms were in denial. That phrase that I used at the beginning, mutual funds are sold, not bought, meant that, hey, that performance stuff doesn't matter. The higher costs don't matter. You used to get people up pontificating on stage about, well, would you rather have a Cadillac or an Oldsmobile or something? It's saying that the more you pay, the better you'll get. And as Jack correctly pointed out, in investing, you get what you don't pay for. It's been a real sea change. I still think there's a place for active management. Vanguard was built on active management, and interestingly, if you look at Vanguard's funds over an extended period of time, their active funds have done as well as or better than their passive funds. But the average active fund has underperformed because it's been overpriced and probably not managed as well as it should be. But that doesn't mean that there aren't active funds out there that will serve investors very well.
Have you shifted around the contents of your personal portfolio as the years have gone by to emphasize index products more?
I have more money in active funds today than I ever do, but it's probably not as high a percentage as it once was. So I do use index funds. I mean, it's not an either or battle. But I have, my shifting in my personal portfolio, I'm much more focused today on philanthropy and giving money away as opposed to just building up a larger and larger nest egg. So I've put more of my investing on autopilot as I'm thinking more about, how to disperse this money as opposed to how to accumulate it. But I don't regret at all the early days researching and looking for best funds and building a portfolio. And were I in that position today, I would still focus very much on trying to find the best funds.
Do you think that we're still, as an industry, too fixated on active versus passive? I know that there are some here at Morningstar that talk about, I think they use phrases like personalization is the new active, right, to try and shift the conversation forward. Do you think that that's a sensible mindset to apply to things, or do you think it's still important for investors to be very aware of the choices that they have, which include actively managed and passively managed funds?
Yeah, I think way too much has been done over active versus passive. I mean, largely it boils down to just cost. And what it really is that the commonsensical notion that low cost is better than high cost. And you know, I used to talk about this horseshoe approach to investing. Said, you know, you could have – we think of it as an either-or thing, like a spectrum where you've got active on one side, passive on the other. So, you know, I think of it more like a horseshoe. And the two prongs, either of those are good choices. You know, one would be great managers at reasonable cost. The other would be low-cost, you know, broad market indexing. And what you wanted to purge from the portfolio was the U-shaped part of that horseshoe, which are sort of, you know, not particularly well-managed, overpriced funds, which could be overpriced index funds. That's what you wanted to purge from your portfolio. And I remember Bogle saying once, well, Phillips, you got a lot of crazy theories like that horseshoe theory and things like that. And I said, well, Jack, isn't that pretty much what you had at Vanguard? You had great managers like John Neff that packaged inexpensively, and then you had index funds. And he goes, well, I guess if you put it that way, it makes a lot of sense. I take it back. But you know, I think too much is done over the active versus passive. I do think the personalization is a very important part because, again, the art of investing is matching investment to investor. And you know, so much of the case for indexing comes from strict performance benchmarking arguments that come out of investment assessment. And all of that is sort of tangential to the match to the investor. You know, so we used to use the phrase we want, the right fund to the right investor for the right reasons. It's that match. And that's what we're starting to see in the behavioral side, this personalization, because at the end of the day, it's about investors meeting their goals. And for many people, a straight index fund is going to be far too volatile for them to stomach. You know, it's how do you water that down? How do you, dilute that in a portfolio to come up with the right mix through asset allocation and other techniques that determines whether the investor has a successful experience or not. And you know, one of the most disastrous experiences investors have had during my career at Morningstar has been with the NASDAQ 100. You know, chasing those stocks full of tech. You know, the tech heavy indexes back during the tech bubble. I mean, that destroyed huge amounts of money from people who said, "Oh, I'm doing the sainted safe thing by buying an index fund." And I remember Jack Brennan, who, in the wake of the Bogle thing, doesn't get nearly enough credit. I mean, he's a good and decent man who had a falling out with Bogle, and their feud was kind of an ugly chapter in the fund industry's history. But Brennan did a lot of really great things for Vanguard and a lot of good things for the industry. And I remember seeing him at an ICI Investment Company Institute conference one year. And he was asked, if you could have done one thing differently during the whole tech bubble, what would have been? And he said, I would have closed the growth index fund. And people were scratching their heads saying, it's an index fund. You don't have any responsibility to close it. People knew exactly what they were getting. Why would you have closed that? And I think one of the great things about Vanguard is they had what the Swiss Army, where all of their senior executives would be on the phone lines periodically, hearing what investors were saying. And Jack knew that people had bought that fund with inflated expectations. They expected it to continue to go up by 70-80% a year. And when it didn't do that, they were disappointed. And the worst thing is he knew that the flows meant that huge amounts of money came in at the peak and then left at the trough. And so here he was saying something that was just completely understandable to the rest of the industry, saying, yeah, we would have closed a successful fund that was easy to sell, or I wish we had done that because we created too many bad investor experiences. And to me, that was a sign of someone who got it, just the way Jack Bogle got it. I mean, Jack Bogle closed a lot of funds and got a lot of press for that at times when his peers would be racing to launch exactly the type of fund that he was closing. So I think in the long run, it's the experience that you create for investors that determines your success in this industry. And those that create good experiences have more people gravitating towards them. People that create bad experiences, well, those people go out and tell other people about that. So, shy away from that. And the advisors that helped people perhaps get into those funds say, hey, I don't want to do something with that fund group again because that's going to bring up that open wound and the money that we lost the last time we went there. And that's where we got into these discussions about salesmanship to stewardship. And it led to the work that that we did on stewardship and fund companies, just asking these questions. You know, what kind of products do they offer? And that's a main way that fund companies define themselves is what products do they offer and at what time do they offer them? You know, are they launching internet funds in 1999 or – you know, are they you know always, you know, trying to either you know amplify or modify the behavioral the fear and greed cycle, and so that's why I come back. You know, we're all in the behavior modification business, and that's the question you've got to ask: are you amplifying the fear and greed cycle, trying to make money off of investors' fear and greed, or are you trying to modify it? And sadly, if you look at say fund advertising, you know, you see over the decades that the fund industry has tried to amplify it. They ran ads for you know tech-heavy funds you know after the peak or at the peak of 1999, and then after the market crashed, they were running ads for their government bond funds, encouraging you to not take risk at the exact time when you should have been taking risk. So unfortunately, that's been a very consistent contrarian indicator over the years.
Let's talk about the ETF space in relation to that. That on the one hand, you've got a group of generally very low-cost products, but in some cases sliced and diced in a way that might not lead to great investor outcomes.
Yeah, it depends on how you look at it. It worries me sometimes this arms dealer mentality saying, well, we don't have any responsibility for how the weapons we create are used or deployed. You know, we just make the weapons. You know, what people do with them is someone else's responsibility. You know, I tend to admire the groups that step up and say, hey, you know, we want to think about what's the end user's experience here and are we, you know, creating something that people are deploying successfully or not. You know, I don't think that you know that everything has to be you know completely watered down or as safe as possible. But if you do something that's more esoteric, you know, it needs to come with more and more warning labels and more guidance on how to deploy it successfully. So, you know, it's hard to know exactly where to draw the line on that. But at the end of the day, you can't take your eye off on you know what's the experience that investors are getting from this. So, you know, I have mixed feelings about ETFs. I mean, I like them a lot. They're low cost. I use them. I was thinking about this the other day. I've never sold an ETF. I've bought a number of them. The trading part of it worries me some. To me, I do not understand why if you are a long-term investor, you need the ability to go in and trade during the day. To me, all that does is encourage bad behavior. Again, a Bogle line. You know, he said the key to investing is you know, don't just do something, sit there. And I remember thinking you know, about – you know, with all of the internet and CNBC and things like this and all of this you know, information bombarding investors, you know, that today we have saddled the average individual with all of the disadvantages that historically only the pros had. Because I talked to fund managers in the early years, and I remember one manager saying, the best thing I can do for my clients really is to go on vacation. He goes, because if I sit in the office, you know, I'm going to be reading all of this different input. I'm doing everything I can to try to add value to the portfolio. And I'm going to end up focusing on the minutiae and sort of lose sight of the big picture. And I'm going to overreact to things. And I'm going to do things that you know, are well-intended but end up actually hurting us in the long run. And I think that's a big reason why indexing works so well is that you buy and hold forever. You don't try to outguess the market. You don't try to you know, constantly be tinkering with things. Again, don't just do something, you know, sit there. It makes a lot of sense. And so, you know, today, you know, it used to be the individuals could just go off and not kind of worry about these things. Now they have access to so much information. And that's been another sea change since I started at Morningstar. You know, when we started, you know, the challenge facing investors was how do you get a hold of some good information so you can make a decision? You know, today the challenge is the exact opposite. It's how do you make sense of an overload of information so that you can make a good decision? And you know, you can't say that you know, having the ability to get out at any moment of the day is a bad thing. But sometimes, you know, not having that is or not being tempted to always you know, be thinking about the exit is a good thing. It keeps you focused on the long term.
What do you think the fund industry is going to look like in 10 years? And how do you think the relationship between investor and fund will have changed over that period of time?
Well, I think we're at a point where it's maybe more difficult than ever to say that because I think, as you point out, that costs are going to zero. I think we're at a period of radical change. And I kind of think of it like the music industry. I mean, it may be that the mutual fund is like the old LP. And you know, we'll still have music 10 years from now, but we may not be listening to it on LPs. And where we used to spend a huge amount of money, I did personally, you know, collecting records, now I spend almost nothing. I get my information or my music digitally. And so the whole music industry has changed. It's gone from something where you were paying a lot for the packaging and the distribution as you did with an LP in record stores, to one where that cost has gone to almost zero and you're getting it instantaneously and digitally. And the same thing I think may happen with asset management. We may be less focused on the vehicle like the mutual fund and maybe either get alternative vehicles or just have the IP delivered to us in electronic fashion. So I think it's a radical change. And if you look at, say, the music industry where things went from a lot of payment for packaging and distribution and it used to be, you know, an artist made their money from selling the records but then went out and toured almost for free. Now it's the inverse of that. Now you sort of give away the music but you make a lot of money on the concerts. And I think maybe the analogy for asset management firms is they get a little way from selling package products more to selling their IP. And I also think that their IP, they'll move from just, you know, here's a fund to focusing more on portfolio assembly, which is sort of the putting the fund into action. It's the live performance of the music, if you will. And so I think you'll see more of an overlap between what asset managers do and what financial planners have historically done. And I think that's one of the reasons you see so many traditional mutual funds buying robo-advisors or developing that kind of capability, either to share with advisors or to offer it directly to the investing public. But the overarching trend that I think is there is it's going to mean lower cost and more choice for investors. The same way as a music listener today, you have an infinite library at your disposal for a fraction of the cost of what buying, you know, a handful of albums used to be.
You've been at the forefront of innovation here at Morningstar and also within the industry, just observing industry practices and evaluating them. I'm curious right now, something that you're working on here at Morningstar that you're particularly excited about and you think will, you know, push Morningstar and the investors that we try to serve in new and interesting directions. And then maybe also some things outside of Morningstar that you've observed that, you know, you're particularly interested or excited about, areas of study or experimentation that have gotten your attention. I'd be curious your perspectives on those things.
Well, this is an exciting time for that kind of experimentation going on because there's so much creativity going on in the fintech space today. You know, at Morningstar, one of the things I'm really proud of is the work we've done on ESG. To me, that's something investors have a right to know. What are the environmental, social, and governance consequences of the where their money is going? And I think making that connection between corporate behavior and the investor dollars, recognizing that the investor is the owner and giving them the rights to have a say in things that matter very much to them and frankly matter to our society, I think that's a big plus. There's another initiative we're doing at Morningstar that you'll see rolling out over the next couple of years that I'm very excited about. And that's beginning to look more at not just what a fund holds, but the delta, you know, how a manager is changing his or her portfolio or how a strategic beta fund is changing its portfolio. What are the implications of that? What are the purchases look like? What do the sells look like? I think of it as a chance to digitize process and take the whole process part of analyzing mutual funds, which has largely been journalistic. You know, you ask a manager, do you have a process, thinking you're going to catch them off guard, and they're going to say, oh, darn, I don't have a process. I forgot to and of course, they have a good stock answer. And then, you know, what you do to follow up is 6 months later, you come back and you ask them the same question, and you see, are they saying the same things as before? And if they do, you give them a big check mark and says, aha, consistency of process, that must be important and lead to better results. And what I think we can do is, you know, that's a hypothesis we can test. You know, they can say you have a hypothesis and you can ask them to describe it, but I think we've got the ability to, using big data, go in and really say, okay, let's really see the proof in the pudding. How do the actions reflect the beliefs and how much are they aligned and do they change over time? Because I think investment management is a science like anything else that you can study and you can identify the better practices and the weaker players. And I think we're still very much in the early days of that. And I think this will lead to a better understanding of what makes a good portfolio and hopefully lead to people deploying funds, whether active or passive or some hybrid form, more successfully.
How about other parts of life apart from investing? I know you are a big lover of literature, but any other areas that have really captured your interest?
You know, I think to me one of the biggest innovations that's happening across our society is just the recognition of how important diversity is. You know, I'm a student of literature, as you mentioned. I love literature. I love philosophy. I love history. And to me, those are all things that sort of reflect diversity. You know, when you're reading literature, you're seeing the world through different eyes, you know, through different points of view. The same thing with philosophy. With history, you're seeing the world through different time points and realize that if you're just centered in one place, you're just getting one perspective. And one of the great things that's happening in society, we're seeing at corporations, we're seeing in boardrooms, people realizing that just having one point of view multiplied by, you know, six people that all have the same point of view is not diversity. We need to get real differences of opinion out there on the table and into the mix. And that's something that I think you're really beginning to see in corporate America. You're starting to see it in government. And I think only good things can come out of that. So that's something that I'm very, you know, very pleased to see happening in our society.
I'm curious, speaking of different perspectives and how one can bring those together optimally, I know that you've served on investment committees in the past. And so I'm just curious, lessons that you would impart based on the experiences that you've had, best practices, worst practices, when it is you thought that the sum exceeded, or I should say the whole exceeded the sum of its parts.
Yeah, that's a terrific question. I can think of lots of, you know, individual examples. I think with investment committees, you know, the real key is just to get away from the knee-jerk things. You know, something's down, it's an embarrassment to the committee that it's lost money. You want to hide your mistakes. And that's just sort of a natural human inclination to do that. But you need to have people on the committee that are willing to step up and remind you, why did we buy this in the first place? Is that still intact? You know, should we stay the course? You know, those become so important. And again, you're arguing against, you know, human inclination, which is why, you know, I say often, you know, we're in the behavior modification business, and it's our own behavior we have to modify. It's not just, you know, we know it all, and these little investors don't know it, and we have to help them out. You know, financial advisors need help with this. Professionals need help. And it's a natural inclination to try to bury your mistakes and trumpet your wins. But if you do that, what are you doing definitionally? You know, definitionally, you're selling low and you're buying high. And that's what we have to reverse. And that's why I think having if you've got a properly constructed, you know, portfolio, you know, committee or investment committee, you can get that voice in there that reminds you of what you really should be doing, even if it goes against your inclinations.
How do you facilitate that? You mentioned proper structure. And so did you find through your experiences that maybe there were some formats or structures that worked less well than others?
You know, one of the things that I think that works really well, and this is an idea I got from Kathy Udelbu, who spent a long time at Morningstar. She said whenever she bought a stock, she would write down what are the reasons that she bought that stock, and she'd put it on a little piece of paper, and then she'd put it in a drawer. And she made it a point that before I ever sell that stock, I go back and read that and see, okay, that was my thesis. Now, judging the stock, don't judge it just on the experience you've had, but judge it on, did it hold to the thesis? Is the thesis still true, and is the stock performing that way? And I think you want to do that same kind of thing structurally as an investment committee, is go in and have clearly articulated reasons for why you own something and only sell it if it no longer – if it's violated those reasons in some way, not just if it's underperformed, because, you know, that time – a lot of times what you're doing then is reacting to the noise in the market, and you're losing sight of your longer-term plan, which probably was fairly well considered when you put it into place.
When you reflect on the arc of fund research, which you've had the opportunity to participate in, shape, observe, you know, what do you think has been the most meaningful improvement that's taken place over the last few decades? And then where are the places where, you know, we as analysts need to continue to sort of shore up our deficiencies or find other ways to uncover opportunities for investors?
Well, I think it's become much more holistic. I mean, today you have a access to a great amount of information, at least in the U.S., not in every market. And managers tend to be pretty willing to talk about their philosophies. We do a better job of, you know, getting out, talking to the managers, getting the full story, putting it into a context. But I think there's still things we can do in big data and helping us to, you know, digitize more of the analysis that can, you know, give the analyst an even better leg up. But to me, one of the most exciting things that's happening in fund research is the bridge to the investor, some of the things that are happening in the behavioral finance world. Because the art of investing is the match between investment and investor. And I think we've done a very nice job of documenting investments. And now there's a greater opportunity than ever to say, how do you create the correct link to the investor? And the other frontier that I think is very important is not to look at investments just in isolation, but to think about how they contribute to portfolio construction. And so I think those are more and more the frontiers that are in front of us. But you can't broach those frontiers without having done the legwork that our analysts have done and continue to do today. And I will point out that, you know, our analysts today are held to much higher standards than we were in the early days. I mean, some of the stuff that, you know, we worked so hard just to fill up the boxes. And so sometimes you were dashing these things off in a matter of minutes. And our analysts today do such a detailed, thorough research job that it's incredibly impressive to me, the caliber of the work that they do.
Do you think that one of the unintended consequences of greater transparency, more ready access to data and unfettered choice is behavioral costs that investors have incurred? And, you know, I guess how should we, maybe as analysts or investors in general, think about some of the trade-offs that are involved between being able to maneuver around in their investments and tinker versus maybe some of the costs that they might unwittingly incur by mistiming their investments?
Yeah, I think that's a real central question. And I think it's one of the reasons, too, why financial advisors have remained so important in this industry and why they've continued – their practices have continued to grow. You know, there was this thinking that there's going to be disintermediation. You know, as you had more information out there, advisors would fade away. Individuals would just – everyone would do it themselves. What a lot of individuals realize is that they weren't equipped to do it themselves. They didn't have – and it's not that they didn't have access to the data. It's just they didn't have the discipline to do that. And so advisors have increasingly become coaches, ones that sort of talk you off the cliff and keep you from overreacting to the short-term events and you know, focusing on the long-term goals. So you know, to me, I think where advisors earn their keep and their perception of where they earn their keep has truly shifted over the years. And I think they're doing things today that are in many ways much more valuable than what they had done historically.
Let's talk about the future of advice, because the cost of advice has come way, way down in terms of some of the robo-advisors and other solutions for providing advice. Do you think that there is enough transparency in the advice landscape for consumers, enough accountability?
You know, it's a tough question to open up, because once you start thinking about transparency and accountability, you get into, well, should we have a performance record for every advisor? And then do we compare them to a benchmark? And are they above that, in which case they're a good advisor? Or are they below that, in which case they're a bad advisor? But the advisors don't deal in the world of benchmarks. They're more in the world that Jeff was talking about earlier of personalization. And you know, their goal is to help a client articulate and identify their goals and then create a path towards that. And you know, the only real source ultimately for judging whether that progress is working out well or not is the client, who has complete access to how their accounts are doing. So I think on one hand, there's great transparency there. And clearly, the advisors are doing something well because they're holding on to the clients. You know, I think in the fund industry for a long time, it's been the typical holding period has been around 3 years. And you hear some things that it's coming down these days with ETFs, and in some ways the calculation gets difficult. But I think a long-term number has been about 3 years. You talk to most RIAs and people like that, they have 2-3% turnover per year. And that's investors voting with their feet that they are satisfied. So they're analyzing the experience that they're having, and they're voting, yes, this is a good experience. So on the one hand, you could say that the advice market is doesn't have a lot of transparency. On the other hand, from the investor's point of view, you have complete transparency to the experience you're getting, and investors are telling us collectively that they're getting a largely good experience.
We've seen fund fees come down. I would say to a certain extent, advice fees, I wouldn't say they've been impervious to those pressures, but they've certainly kept them at bay to a greater extent. And so I'm curious what your view is on that and whether you think we're moving inexorably on a path towards fee pressure there. And also a related question is, based on the interactions that you have with advisors and planners, the role that technology will play in enabling advice and making them more efficient to maybe counteract some of the fee pressure that they're under.
Yeah, I think there is fee pressure, but there's also a lot of satisfaction from clients on the experience that they're having. So that sort of offsets to some degree that fee pressure. I think most clients react to the experience that they have, not simply to the cost in isolation of it. So I don't know that the fee pressure will be as great on advisors as it's been on manufacturers, if you'll use sort of the industry's nomenclature. But that said, I do think that there will be more attention. There'll be more models that are thrown out there. Personally, I pay my advisor a flat fee, not a percentage of assets. And if you worked it out in basis points, it would be a very low number. If I'm paying 20 or 30, 40 basis points, it'd be many, many times what I'm paying. But it's a fair fee, and it's one that she's very happy to work for. And we talk about it and revisit it, and it's money that I'm very happy to pay, because I think I get good counsel. And But I think more and more people will do that and explore different models. So the basis point thing works very well. If you're starting off for smaller accounts, there are ways that can be very efficient and it's very seamless. There are a lot of positives to that. But higher net worth individuals, basis points suddenly don't make as much sense anymore. You end up paying huge amounts for the same service that you got at a much lower level. So I think you'll see that start to bifurcate in different models. Come into play. I think like a lot of people in this industry, I admire what Cheryl Garrett and others have done with the charging by the hour and fees like that. And I think you'll just see different models emerge. And hopefully investors will be smart about it. I think that paying for advice is money well spent, but it's also very easy to overpay for that advice. And you want to be smart about this because it will have an impact on the ultimate success that you have.
Why has a fiduciary standard for advisors been so hard to enact in your view?
Well, I think because fiduciary standards in general are very hard to enact. Look at ERISA and all of the unintended consequences that had, and you worry about sort of the police state that's that's sort of created by this. It is the intentions I think are terrific around this, and I think we are moving in many ways more and more towards this kind of an area. But it's easy to see where you can come up with lots of. Bureaucracy, lots of red tape, lots of things that just don't make sense in this. And so it's one thing that's very easy to come up with a slogan and to say something. It's something else that's very, very difficult in practice to make this make a meaningful difference for investors. But I think the debate is healthy, and I think the focus on doing what's right for the investor is the focus that this industry has to have if it's going to thrive.
Don, it's always enlightening to talk to you. I'm always motivated after talking to you. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Thanks. It's a pleasure.
Thanks for joining us on The Long View. If you liked what you heard, please subscribe to and rate The Long View for Morningstar on iTunes, Google Play, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
You can follow us on Twitter at Christine_Benz.
And at SYouth1, which is SYOUTH and the number one. Finally, we'd love to get your feedback. If you have a comment or a guest idea, please email us at thelongview@morningstar.com. Until next time, thanks for joining us.
This recording is for informational purposes only and should not be considered investment advice. Opinions expressed are as of the date of recording. Such opinions are subject to change. The views and opinions of guests on this program are not necessarily those of Morningstar Inc. and its affiliates. Morningstar does not guarantee the accuracy and/or the completeness of the data presented herein. Jeff Patak is an employee of Morningstar Research Services, LLC. Morningstar Research Services, LLC is a subsidiary of Morningstar, Inc. and is registered with and governed by the U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission. Morningstar Research Services shall not be responsible for any trading decisions, damages, or other losses resulting from or related to the information, data, analyses, or opinions, or their use. Past performance is not a guarantee of future results. All investments are subject to investment risk, including possible loss of principal. Individuals should seriously consider if an investment is suitable for them by referencing their own financial position, investment objectives, and risk profile before making any investment decisions.